This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. It is a Monday, and it's the one with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu here in Studio 2 in Mondays with the Mayor. Mayor Wu, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Are you hearing me okay in the headphones?
I'm not hearing you in these headphones.
But, okay, so let me have you come square on.
Nope, you got it?
Yep. Great. So listen, you are sporting some new fashion today.
It's lovely.
So tell me about your fashion statement today.
So I'm here with the hot off the, I guess, recycled presses, this year's BAA Marathon jacket. And it's a, we were trying to figure out the color and finally just looked it up on their website. It is a silver violet this year.
It's gray.
With, I was thinking periwinkle.
And I like it.
It's beautiful with yellow stripes. This year's a 10th anniversary of the marathon bombings in 2013. So in addition to kind of the full-on event returning as the impacts of the pandemic are beginning to recede, we have a full day of commemorations to really mark the experiences that our city and survivors, first responders, our healthcare community went through and continue to build on. And on the Saturday, the April 15th, the actual anniversary date.
So two follow-up questions on that, one on the fashion side and one on the serious side. We'll do the serious first. How do you get yourself ready to be in that many different spaces where we are? I mean, we always celebrate our strength. We always celebrate our resilience. But that will also be a time of marking, a time of great trauma and grief. How do you get yourself ready to be the touchstone for the city on those days?
Well, this is really, you know, in spaces where we have just such depth of emotion and memory and shared experience, I find my role is to help provide a platform and channel what our community members really are feeling and want to see. And so the survivor community has, you know, as always, been incredibly generous and loving with their time in giving a lot of feedback on what this year could look like. And there was a strong sense that, yes, we want to ensure that we are looking back, remembering and marking what we all went through collectively, but what certain family members went through in particular, as well as not just staying there, but making this a forward-looking event where part of the celebrations and part of the commemorations, you know, we'll start the morning with a wreath laying with the survivor community at the site of the bombings, and then start off the BAA 5K will then begin after that. And then later, community organizations that are running groups, whether it's neighborhood-based groups or groups to encourage those who haven't traditionally seen themselves represented in the running community, we have all sorts of grassroots energy around the running community and what that means for health, wellness, but also getting to support and know each other. So we're going to encourage all of those groups to participate in a run from a particular spot that they may choose, meet up at a point on Boylston Street so that we can all walk together, again, with our first responders and healthcare community and survivors to the newly redesigned finish line, which will be a commemoration as well.
And to the jacket, it strikes me that there is this level of planning down to that level of detail. The jacket's usually a very specific blue, then with the yellow. Though many know it on Red Sox uniforms from the last couple of years too. Why do something different?
I wasn't involved in this part of the decision making, so I'm sure the BAA will add more context to this when we do share more. But for me, what jumps out about this is that the yellow is very much the same yellow as from those 2013 jackets. I remember the colors well because that was the first time that I was running for office, and our campaign headquarters was right there in the South End, just a couple streets over, and the visual kind of seared into my mind of people finding their way to our space and everyone looking to each other in that moment. And then the base color, this, you know, silver violet, is a little bit of a muted color, I think, in remembrance and to mark the solemnity also of what we're remembering.
We talk with you every month. There'll be a chance, you know, at least in March, if not also April, to talk a little bit more about it. But it was a striking thing to have you come in, right, today with that jacket. I do want to move kind of into our agenda for today. Not surprisingly, I want to start with rent control. And I'm just going to begin by reminding listeners. So basically, the basic proposal, and there is more, is to tie allowable annual rent increases to the consumer price index. Plus 6%. So whatever inflation plus 6%, unless that's going to take rent increases over 10%. So the overall right. cap, that doesn't mean it would always be 10%, mm-hmm. but the maximum cap would be 10%. And then there are some exemptions like buildings, for new buildings for 15 years, small owner-occupied buildings, 2 to 6 units, et cetera. So first, news of the day, the lawsuit. Mass Landlords files a lawsuit against the city about the proposal. They say they've twice requested emails. They want emails. They're concerned about the process that went into developing this. Court records show they've gotten one. There have to be more than one email.
I'm sure that everything is going to get sorted out on the transparency side. It is our commitment always to follow the public records law to the fullest extent that is possible, and even to go beyond that where we can. I would say, you know, we fully stand behind the process and the expertise that went into this proposal. It is now in a kind of the formal part of the process, going through the city council, and then hopefully after that, upon passage, up to the state house for approval. But you know, we know that many of the special interest groups who might be either listening to fear-mongering or practicing fear-mongering here really are just trying to stop a policy that people are scared of. And I just want to remind these groups and everyone that, you know, it's important to just start from the same place of facts and what we're actually proposing and talking about. We know that the economic situation is uncertain right now. We know that there are burdens on families of all kinds, renters and landlords, especially our smaller property owners. We have taken care to put the specific provisions in, the nuanced details that would address the concerns and give the protections for specific groups that might be impacted otherwise. For example, there are exemptions for smaller properties that are owner-occupied. There are exemptions for new construction. And even the total cap proposed in terms of the allowable rent increases, in an average year, that would be rents could increase between, you know, on average, 7 to 8%. And again, in high inflation years, all the way up to 10%.
So
most landlords across the city are not increasing rents by that much. This is really about guardrails to protect everyone.
I hear you on that. And we've talked before, and I know you've been very clear that you knew in threading this needle, as is often the case when one tries to thread a needle, pretty much nobody's happy with you because, you know, advocates don't think you've done enough. Landlords and property owners are concerned you're doing too much. I am going to push back a little, mm-hmm. and I'm struck by the fear-mongering piece because Mass Landlords, for example, says, we've got this whole dog and pony show about how we're trying to help people, but the origins of the proposal are really confusing and unclear and seem to favor developers over renters and landlords. So let's stipulate dog and pony show, that's framing, right? That being said, why is it necessarily the case that pushback from property owners who are concerned about long-term viability and profitability is fear-mongering?
I think a lot of people are drawing the analogy, whether it's a group that is trying to put a lawsuit forward to just add more news and make sure that there's as much potential delay in the process as possible, to others who are putting money behind an effort to put a message out there that this is taking us backwards.
Create or the Boston Real Estate Board $400,000
right. Or
campaign
to assert
to oppose
that City Hall can't do math or this or that. This is a different proposal that we're putting forward now compared to what used to exist in Massachusetts and in many places decades ago, or even in some of the cities that are being brought up as examples of what to avoid. This is a proposal that is meant to be in concert and balanced with, complementary to a whole range of supports and resources and policy changes that we're trying to make to increase housing supply, to boost home ownership, to speed up our processes so that everything is more efficient and clear and transparent and predictable. And so this is one piece, but we are going to, we won't stop, and we will refuse to back down from pushing for every possible change for housing affordability. This is the one issue that is threatening our economy and our families most.
Transparency, that word's come up a couple of times. You know, this particular lawsuit from Mass Landlords is on getting emails. Transparency is important to you. You said at the top, listen, we'll obey public records laws. That's
yes,
important.
Absolutely.
Are there, we knew. We knew this was going to be a tough one. We knew you were going to be trying to thread a needle. We knew there are several steps here. The city council has to be in favor. Then eventually, if it makes it through there, it's got to go to the legislature. It's got to go to the governor. Are there transparency lessons from the process so far that might lead you to do something more or different with other proposals for big change that you want to make in the future?
Well, I think we had a year-long process where the committee members represent a wide range of interests and professional experiences and viewpoints and ideologies as well, those who have been fighting to bring some form of rent stabilization or rent control to Massachusetts for decades, those who oppose it and own properties and are developers or have been involved, and then those who study this for a living and are in academia. Each of those meetings was public. The minutes from those meetings, many of them were convened with full audience participation, whether it was by Zoom or in person. And the results only then fed into a proposal that still has to go through the actual formal public process of city council hearings and potential vote and then state processes as well. I think, you know, we weren't quite sure what the timeline would be exactly when we started this. You know, there are many other things swirling around at the city at the same time. And it would be nice to, you know, we kind of had set out in the beginning, by this month, we hope to have finished our survey of policies around the country. By this month, finish our Boston survey. Things kind of got a little bit stretched out as other priorities and urgent emergencies came about. And so there was a little bit of time at the end where I think it fell off for a little bit of when will we see the actual proposal. But our goal was always to bring it back up in time for this next legislative cycle. And so we're right on target there.
So one more thing on this, Mayor Wu. So the city council, first hearings last week, lots of back and forth. Once again, in some ways, a microcosm of the two sides of displeasure about this proposal that you've made. The next hearing with council is Thursday, March 2nd. Have you been in conversation with Boston City Council members since the last hearing? And do you have a sense of what to expect on Thursday?
I saw a little bit of the hearing, and my team has been is in constant communication with our partners on the council on all sorts of issues. There are many, many hearings, including one this afternoon on the development process and planning and some of the changes we're hoping to make there, a similar home rule petition. So I know everyone on the council shares a feeling of urgency that we need to protect residents and renters in our city. We need to do more to bring housing prices down. I don't know exactly where the votes will end up because we certainly, you know, I think sometimes when each vote is taken on its own, there's pressure to say, does this fulfill everything that's needed on this issue? And the reality is that there is no single policy or proposal that will fix everything. We need to do all that we can at the same time. And this, I hope, will be seen in the context of all of the other changes and programs and investments that we're making as well.
All right. So I am going to stay in housing for a second longer because you made reference to other changes, home rule petitions, one of which would be changes to the Boston Planning and Development Agency. All right, so I have a policy question, but first, I have not read anywhere a layperson's three-sentence description of what exactly it is you're trying to change. So can we just start there? The three sentences that anybody in the city of Boston would say, oh, now I get what she's trying to do.
Yeah, yeah, because there's a whole lot of technical jargon attached to it. The top line is that we have an incredibly complicated, unpredictable, bureaucratic system that was built up over many years of tweaking various things. It is unique across the country, and it is not serving our city well. What we need to do to fix that is to change it away from being a very reactive system where we grow according to the specific proposals that are put forward by developers and maybe tweak them around the edges, but then it doesn't fit together across entire neighborhoods or across the entire city. We need to change it from that reactive approach to one where we are proactively planning with our communities. What are all of the needs that we need to meet through the growth of the city and not just building by building?
All right. So then the Boston Planning Development Agency, it's had so many names. We're just going to go BPDA now. The board pushes back, opts not to vote on the petition that you brought forward. Ted Landsmark, one of the board members, says, quote, "It appears we put the cart before the horse by asking us to engage in planning toward reform without having the evidence and data that indicates specifically what the reforms are," end quote. So with that blanket definition you've just given us, give us one explicit reform example that would get from point A that you talked about to the point B you want.
Okay, there's a couple. I'm going to talk about the particular home rule petition that is related to that vote or lack thereof and the city council hearing today, and then another set that is separate from that. So the actual legislative change that is being proposed is to update the existing agency's mission, which is still grounded in a 1950s and 60s idea of, quote unquote, eradicating urban blight and decay, you know, bring development in because cities were places that people were running away from. We are no longer in that place. And so it would be updating that mission to direct our planning development efforts to resiliency, affordability, and equity, which are the big, big needs that we need to address today. That is going up in a home rule petition, again, a hearing today with the city council, that would tweak and in some ways just update what the point of the of our planning efforts and development efforts are. The executive order that went before the BPDA primarily as a notification mechanism, that was meant to say even before this home rule passes at the city council and the state level, let's start taking action along those lines already. We can voluntarily adopt that mission and move away from old ways of doing things, even as we're waiting for the process to play out there later. You know, that executive order, even the board has recognized we don't really need more formal authorization to do that. That is within the purview of Chief of Planning Arthur Jemison to just do. And so those efforts are already ongoing, and we've already been partnering with the board on things like Article 80 reform, streamlining our processes. One separate topic, I mean, related but distinct from this, which sometimes is getting mixed into all of it, is how we're changing the structure of the organization itself. So right now, the BPDA is completely off the books from the city, not right, subject to the same kind of budget oversight or employee structures as every other department.
And you want it more on the books.
And if we move it back over, starting from the planning function, that will give the same accountability, but it'll also allow for coordination and increased investment in these efforts when they can be tied to all of the planning that is being done, not only around buildings and development, but our school system, our parks, our transportation department. Some of that is happening just voluntarily and, again, through extraordinary coordination, but it needs to be fully embedded into the structure of how we do business.
So, gosh, we could do this all hour. I'm like, do I ask one more? Yes, I'm going to ask one more on this. All right. So, when you say it that way, right, you sort of lay it out, oh, yeah, and it's going to be more on the books and we can streamline. But there is something to be said for not everything being under the control of the city. So what's lost if this change happens?
Yeah, I think the original motivation, and again, that I could go through, I've written a very long report on this. And so there were a couple, okay, I'm trying to decide how much to go down the rabbit. Okay,
only
I'm just
a little.
All right. So the light version is that, like many cities of the time, Boston wanted in the 50s and 60s to have dedicated resources to grow in this sort of old way of thinking, eradicate urban blight. When other cities backed away from that, Boston actually went all in even more and collapsed more and more power into the agency and then took it off the books as well. By putting it back on, we get that coordination, but what some might say is lost is an independence to that structure or dedicated funding that goes just for planning and development review rather than getting sucked into the day-to-day emergencies that might come up. If there's a pot of money available, why would we put it towards long-term planning versus a short-term announcement or something flashy that we could do? There are ways to protect against that. For example, if we were to put, for example, funding in our parking meter fund specifically can only be used for transportation infrastructure purposes. It can't be pulled to any use in the city. So there are ways to think about if we want to protect a pot of resources to go towards a long-term need that might otherwise have the risk of getting deprioritized, we can put those protections in. The other point is that even though it has been set aside and separated, the status quo has not been working. We have not been delivering housing affordability in the way that we need. We have not been delivering coordinated planning for the long term. And most of the planning department currently at the BPDA is getting pulled into reacting to the development proposals as they come in as well. So it's our goal to separate that and create that space for long-term planning.
It's Mondays with the Mayor, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, still here with us in Studio 2. Let's hit a few like newsy things. One question, one answer, okay. And we'll jump around a little bit. Okay, so first, Governor Healey this morning announces her tax relief package. As part of it, she's proposing an increase to the rental deduction. So from $3,000 to a $4,000 cap annually. Also tax breaks for low-income seniors. Have you seen any pieces of the plan? Your reactions to what you know so far?
I have not seen anything. I know this was a campaign promise of hers, and so it's great to see follow through. I don't know how all the pieces add up all together, but certainly families are struggling and need relief, and our tax code is one way where we can provide that targeted relief. I do know that we also want to ensure that there are revenues left over for the long-term planning and infrastructure, that transportation and education and all of those priorities that sometimes have been underfunded because they are more long-term. Part of what passed over the last year with the Fair Share Amendment was to dedicate funding for those priorities. And so hope to see how those pieces fit together.
And for listeners, Fair Share Amendment, also known as the Millionaire's Tax, an extra tax on earnings over $1 million in a given year going towards education and transportation. How often are you in contact with the governor? Are the two of you talking regularly? Is it pretty distant?
Our teams are in constant communication. We are most often in text communication, I would say, but just a check-in here and there. And then we get together when there are issues to discuss. And I've found her and her team to be incredibly responsive and knowledgeable about the city's needs.
All right, let's move to Mass and Cass. Boston Medical Center says it's going to stop providing urgent care style addiction services at the former Roundhouse Hotel, the deadline for that, March 31st, and they basically said not enough funding to keep going with that. It raises into question the residential piece as well, which I think faces the end of funding in June. So this has been an important part of your approach there. Did you know this end in services was coming? Can you stop it? Do you want to stop this end in services and coming? And what comes next for the Roundhouse given this moment?
Our initial goal a year and 2 months ago was to provide a housing and services surge so that we could really tackle the humanitarian crisis of widely spread out permanent encampments at Mass and Cass. That issue with the hundreds of units that were created with services, we've been able to transition everyone who was originally living in the encampments into these housing units and many folks now, dozens of residents, onto permanent housing even after that first stop and in transitional supportive housing. And so, you know, do I wish that we had support from other levels of government and funding sources so that these badly needed services could be a constant? It would make all the difference in the world. Did we know that this was meant initially to be a solution to a particular challenge that we had, and also a proof point for what would work? That was always our expectation. We are looking to try to identify funding so that we can continue the housing services as long as possible as we are starting to think about what the next steps are. And from the beginning, I think the Roundhouse was an area that was accessible and close by, connected to Boston Medical Center, right nearby so that residents could feel comfortable. But there has been a strong sense that we want to provide these services more accessibly across all parts of the city and the state as well.
We invited our texting group members to send in questions, and you can join that texting group by sending the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's 617-766-0382. Barbara in Boston wrote in, what about the Mass and Cass open-air drug market and homelessness? How can she help? Can she decentralize resources? The current focus has just moved the problem to a different street, and the city has needles all over. That's the first part of Barbara's. So let me let you address that.
We need to keep up the momentum. It might not feel like it day to day, but if you look at the actual numbers, it is a very different situation now than it was a year ago or 2 years ago. And this was a long, long-standing challenge. We have numbers now. We have a set of coordination and services in place so that every single week, again, unlike a year plus ago, there are dozens of street cleanings. It is a much more sanitary and healthy condition, safe condition for everyone. Our street outreach unit from the Boston Police is there in partnership with public health. We have now received partnership from sources like the Boston Foundation so that we can continue case management 24 hours a day and not just 9 to 5 during the weekdays. As of this morning, there were 51 individuals today in the area, which is down quite a bit from the numbers that we initially had.
What does in the area mean? How do you define in the area?
Just in the geographic area of Atkinson Street, Southampton Street, all of the surrounding areas.
Does that include an overnight stay, or does that mean just a census this morning? Do you understand my question?
Oh, I see. Yes, that was a census as of this morning.
Okay. Okay. So let's move on. Frieda Brasfield, city administration and finance director, been put on administrative leave after she pleaded not guilty to money laundering charges related to a scheme to smuggle synthetic cannabinoids into a state prison. She's due back in court on March 1st. A number of local activists and advocates have come out in support of her. She is on leave from the city during this time. What are the next steps for the city in this instance?
We are not jumping to any conclusions here. And there's been such a strong sense of sadness within City Hall because Frieda's a long, long time beloved employee of the city and has served in numerous roles under various administrations. And so we are waiting for more information to come out through that process and following our own policies where whenever there is a charge of situation that threatens to undermine the public trust, that employee is placed on unpaid leave no matter what level they are on. And so we're following our own HR policies, but withholding any sort of judgment or jumping to conclusions as the process unfolds.
We have Boston Mayor Michelle Wu here in Studio 2. Right now, we're kind of popping around on a whole bunch of news of the day. So March 1st is going to mark 1 year since you launched the fare free bus expansion for the bus routes 23, 28, 29. It's a 2 year thing. So we're about at 1 year. What do you know about usage numbers? What are you tracking?
These are the busiest routes anywhere in the city. It makes a difference. And the two primary ways that it helps our communities and residents is one, of course, there's just that sense of ease and convenience. The number of people we've talked to who said, I don't need to worry or think or ration how many times I can go back and forth to make a quick trip to the grocery store or run home before going back to class at RCC, Roxbury Community College. But the other main way that it has made a difference is in the routes, the speed when people can board on all doors and don't have to wait one by one by one to get through that checkpoint of paying. It makes a big difference for how quickly the buses can complete their routes and come back for the next run.
And do you have data that ridership is up and that those routes are faster?
Yes.
And will you be publishing that data? Or I apologize if you have published it and I've missed it.
We had a report that came out already a few months ago. I'm sure we will keep updating that. And our goal is we need to be a city where everything is accessible for free by any resident. And that can be through mass transit or the MBTA. That could be through bicycling or walking. But our vision is that transportation should be the vehicle, if you will, the platform to reach opportunity rather than a barrier. And right now, for more folks, unfortunately, than not, it does feel like an extra hurdle to prevent you from getting the getting to the job that you could, or the educational opportunity, or even just for fun and to know that you could spend some time with friends or acquaintances and be able to get back home affordably and reliably.
Okay, because you said the word bicycle, I'll pull in one of the questions from our texting group. Luke of Boston says, how is the progress going on the 2023 bike lane expansions? Can we expect the full 10 miles by the end of the year?
I can't remember. I was just looking at these numbers a couple days ago. I know we are on track to the numbers that we had put forward before, which was about a doubling of how much we've done any year up until now. But I can't remember if 10 was the exact number or not. So I will follow up on that front. But our goal is not just to dramatically increase how fast we are moving this year relative to previous years, but also to have that long-term vision in place so that we know at a certain point, everyone in Boston will be within a very convenient and reachable distance of an accessible cycling network. And so we have some work to do on that front, identifying the key intersections. We had some great news with federal funding that Senator Markey and Senator Warren and our congressional delegation have secured from the federal government, $9 million in our Safe Streets grants that will help us tackle the most dangerous intersections for pedestrians, cyclists, and drivers and residents in general. And so we now have some resources to move quickly on that, and we'll continue our planning even beyond this year.
Okay, so Mayor Wu, one more in this kind of rapid fire one, and outdoor dining. And in this case, on street dining. So the city is continuing to codify how this is going to work. This year, the controversy is the fact that in the North End, restaurants will not be able to use parking spots. And the requirements for the amount of sidewalk space necessary to use patios on sidewalk space essentially limits a lot of the restaurants in the North End because of the widths of the sidewalks there. My understanding was part of the argument originally was that the Sumner Tunnel closure was going to drive a lot of more traffic through. That is still happening, but now on a shorter term basis. It does seem like North End restaurants aren't getting the same shot, the same deal as restaurants in other neighborhoods. Is this unfair? So you've argued why you have to do it. Mm-hmm. So with that in place, is this unfair, and is there a future where there is a fair way for restaurants in all the Boston neighborhoods to have access to the revenues that can come from on-street and outdoor dining?
Yeah, I know how painful and stressful this is for small business owners who are still very much feeling the impact of the pandemic and all of the policies that directly impacted their livelihoods and their employees over the last couple years. This, you know, our neighborhoods are for the people who live there, and we need to ensure that our residents have quality of life and accessibility and all of the amenities that they deserve across every neighborhood of the city as well. And we also need our small businesses to be successful and thriving as drivers of our economy, but also a destination to make each neighborhood fun and welcoming. There is no place in the city like the North End when it comes to the density of restaurants, the narrowness of the sidewalks. And that is why that neighborhood has always been such a draw and delight for visitors to experience and to visit. Because of the various, it's not just the Sumner Tunnel, but the ongoing bridge reconstruction, the changes in accessibility for some of the parking lots that have been used as parking alternatives, the immense costs and coordination that were required, we needed to ensure that we could do this right. The outdoor dining program, as of 3 years ago, was really started as a pandemic measure for
kind
restaurants.
Kind of seat of the pants.
Yeah, they didn't have an ability to have people indoors because of the regulations. And so let's just kind of turn the other way when it came to a lot of requirements, accessibility requirements, other safety, alcohol service requirements. And so there was a very light review, which was a completely different experience than how patios individually had been permitted in the past. We are retaining the vast majority of that ability to have a quick review and, look at those who had already had patios through this experiment that was run over the last couple of years, and maintain that, codify that. But in a neighborhood where the density on street using, you know, right in the line of traffic, the ability to have accessibility and maintain city services like sanitation and all of that. We need to take a year there to really figure out how this could be sustainable.
Okay. And that might mean that in the future, characteristics of neighborhoods might affect what is and isn't doable or allowed when it comes to outdoor dining.
That's right. And it's the width of the sidewalk. It's the density. We want to make this possible for restaurants to thrive in every single neighborhood, but different areas do have different physical infrastructure attributes. And so if it's a long-term conversation about how do we make sure that every neighborhood has sidewalks wide enough to accommodate outdoor dining, that is a medium to long-term conversation that I think we'd be excited to have, and we'll have bring that up in the course of the conversations this year.
Boston Mayor Michelle Wu is still here with us in Studio 2. So actual plowable amounts of snow coming tomorrow, which this winter is a little bit unusual. I think the big question is coming right off of winter break. Are the kids hoping there's going to be a snow day tomorrow, or do they want you to try to influence such outcome? I can tell you, if my kids when they were younger thought that I would have any influence on that, they'd have been strong-arming me about it.
We have had very little opportunity to break out all the snow boots and everything for the kids. I can't say that I am regretful of that in terms of every time we get notification that we're using more of the salt and plows and the budget that comes along with that. I think about that very intensely. We are expecting a current projection somewhere between 2 and 5 inches in the Boston area, which is right below our threshold for when we usually treat that as a kind of emergency or major significant snow event. But we're still following the forecast very carefully and have not made any calls as it relates to potential school impacts the next day. But we will keep everyone updated. And, you know, coming off of school vacation myself, I'm very happy that school is back on. So I will try not to let that bias my decision as well.
Every kid listening at 3 o'clock just went, oh, come on. All right, so listen, now into some more serious stuff around schools. New findings from the Massachusetts Department of Education about students with disabilities, saying that their rights were violated because of dysfunctional school bus service between October 21, October 2022, having to do with missed and late bus service, amount of time missed, alternate plans parents had to make in terms of transportation. Lots of demands from the state to fix this. New hiring of a coordinator for transportation by July 1st, plans to address the shortfalls by mid-March. So a couple of things. One, I have to believe it was deeply upsetting to you to hear these findings. Were you expecting them, and what was your first reaction?
We know that there have been significant, structural, long-standing problems with our bus transportation system for some time, problems that we have been working really hard to kind of get at the root of and pull up in partnership with our bus providers, with our bus drivers and all school communities. Some changes that have been made since then include having a better pipeline for hiring. The union, Bus Drivers Union, and the bus provider TransDev have created a new way to onboard bus drivers to fill vacancies. We know that the system is very much impacted by traffic overall in the city as well. And so Boston has an incredibly complex system where, unlike many cities across the country, the public schools here, our Boston Public School District, is responsible for busing not only BPS students, but also students of every type of school, charter, parochial.
Students living in Boston who don't attend the Boston Public Schools.
That's right, including placements that go very far out of state even as well, when there are requirements for specialized services or a different placement, for example. And so when we are providing transportation for everyone and we only have control over the start times, for example, of our own BPS schools, it puts a level of complexity that is outside of our control, again, unique to our district relative to other cities. So we are working to try to engage everyone in this conversation. We know overall that we have to do better. One piece also, and in addition to working with the hiring pipeline and the contract and having accountability and operational improvements there, We are also, for the first time ever, going to have performance metrics in the bus contract. And there's been a little bit of back and forth on this front, around the bidding process. We are very excited.
Alarms raised at the state level that having only one bus company bid and it being the bus company you're currently using could actually violate state law or regulation.
Yeah, and I want to just give a quick update on this, that we have been working very closely with the Inspector General's office, and they have analyzed every bit of this process, have given us recommendations that we are eager to continue following through on.
To make sure you stay in compliance.
That's right, but we do not need to rebid. And in fact, part of this was the explanation that for the first time ever, we are doing something very different, which is we are attaching clear accountability measures where if students aren't gotten to school on time by the bus company and the vendor, that their pay, the funding going to the bus company, will actually be reduced. And so many of the bidders who were involved throughout the process of learning about this and questioned if this was financially feasible, and this, many of the others ended up dropping out of that bidding process. We are glad that our current vendor appreciates and recognizes the improvements we've made so far and that we have a lot more to go.
So those are repercussions, and they explain the bus contract question I was going to ask you. So you had that one off at the pass. The learning loss dimensions of what the state found and the work it wants the city to do to make up for that. Speak to parents directly about that. What do you do about that?
This is something that weighs heavily on me. In fact, one of the early motivations for me to say I actually want to make a difference in city government was when I interned for Mayor Menino. I was raising my sister at the time. We lived probably if you were driving in a private car, which we didn't have at that time, it would probably was a 12 to 17 minute drive to school. It would end up being 45 minutes sometimes on the bus when the bus came on time or if it came on time. And so Mayor Menino let me actually go and sit in the bus hotline area to just see what was happening and try to understand the system. It was, we're now everything is electronic and parents can follow with GPS. And there's been a lot of improvements since 10, 12 years ago when I was sitting there in stacks of paper taking calls. But the fact that we're still working on this is due to some really deep underlying challenges that I am determined to fix. One other measure and dimension of this, again, in addition to the workforce and how we prepare our drivers, in addition to the performance metrics and how we hold the vendor accountable, is how we deliver services ourselves as a district. We have had in the teacher's contract in the past very rigid requirements for students with disabilities to be in certain ratios of classrooms. And so that in practice had meant that services were segregated in specific schools. And so if a student was diagnosed as needing services according to an individualized education plan or an IEP, they would then be given a list of a very small number of schools, most likely far away from their homes, to be bused to.
Okay.
Now we have a system where with the teachers union and with all of our educators, we are rebuilding that from scratch, putting a huge investment of $50 million into getting the staffing right, where the services will now follow each student rather than students having to chase after the services. And that will have a huge transportation impact as well.
So as we're talking about schools, I do want to ask about school committee, but Kathy of Scituate actually wrote in and asked about this on our texting group. I'd love to hear her talk about electing school committee members and why she prefers to maintain that control. She's talking, in fact, about the Boston City Council wanting to move to an elected school committee. You had run on the desire for a hybrid. They wanted to move to elected. You said not, as I read it, not at this time. Was the answer no, or was it not at this time?
The answer to all elected school committee was no. I have always held this position. And again, as someone who has been involved as a parent or legal guardian or city councilor and now in my current role, helping to partner with overseeing the entire system, that accountability and responsibility I take as the most important thing that we're doing is preparing our young people and surrounding them with the opportunities that we know are possible in the city. This is an area where I just so deeply respect and appreciate where the proponents are coming from who are advocating for an elected committee, that families need to have a stronger voice. There needs to be accountability. And we are committed to ensuring that we can keep moving as quickly as possible to reach more families in the languages that are spoken by our students and their families, and in the times of day and the mechanisms that are actually productive and get us to the right policies to begin with.
So the hybrid piece, which you campaigned on, is that still a plan and priority for you?
My focus right now is ensuring that we can get this district the stability, the resources, and the acceleration of progress that is possible under our new superintendent and the resources currently before us. And so it's not my priority at this time to shake everything up by changing to a new governance structure. We have a lot of ongoing initiatives, and what I hear from so many of our educators and families is that, in fact, the biggest factor over the last several years has been so much transition and instability with new leadership, new initiatives, new staff coming in with new leadership, that we really have a moment where we are on the verge of changing, you know, uprooting structures that haven't worked, implementing really big changes. And I'd like to do everything that I can to provide the superintendent with the space and the resources that she and her team need to just get us firmly rooted in our new direction, which is what our students and families deserve.
Okay, let's end quickly on a couple of lighter notes. I saw on your Twitter feed you braved the weather this weekend and got the hot dog.
At opening Sullivan's weekend every year.
Who took the picture? Because the three of
my husband was.
And what was the order?
I always go with two hot dogs, everything on it, fries. I did not get a shake this time, although I very much wanted to. It was just a little too cold.
What flavor shake would it have been?
Chocolate.
All right. And are you making playoff plans for the Celtics?
I mean, we are season ticket holders up in the balcony, so that email did come in that, you know, we these are the dates and these are the provisions to follow through with the games. But I'm just going to keep knocking on wood and crossing everything that I have. They look so good right now, but we got to stay focused.
Okay, but would the boys get a chance to see at least one playoff game, do you think?
I hope so.
All right. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu has been with us here in Studio 2 for our regular Mondays with the Mayor. Mayor Wu, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, and Rob Lane, with Bart Tocci and John Bender. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. Titus Faladun is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for tuning in today. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.